Thank you, Don. And I think the answers are yes to the Adelaide Festival, but no to Barton Terrace, from the humanities at least. Members of the press, my academic colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, I was delighted to be invited to talk to this luncheon, but I want to clear up a couple of possible misapprehensions. If you thought that this M. Gillies was my distant relative Max, incidentally not my brother, as reported recently in the Advertiser, then I'll have to apologise for the lack of laughs. If you're a true believer, and you thought, along with the Sunday Mail, that I was going to introduce the Labor Party's Knowledge Nation platform, then I'll also have to disappoint you. I'm not a member of that party, or indeed any party. But I will repeatedly be referring to the report of Barry Jones's task force, the Knowledge Nation report, and also referring to the federal government's innovation action plan called Backing Australia's Ability. Knowledge has always been the key item of trade in universities and among academic fraternities. We trade it between teachers and pupils, between disciplines and between faculties. Increasingly now, we trade it with industry partners, invited within our hallowed university groves to enrich our perspectives and also to help our balances of payment. Knowledge is hard to measure and harder to cost. Its effects and benefits are more tangible as part of credentialed training, but less tangible as part of liberal education. Knowledge has only recently been recognised as a chief item of trade between nations. Australia, for instance, rode to trading fame on the back of the sheep, while South Africa did it with gold nuggets. In the 21st century, we are repeatedly told basic commodities and services are not the key generators of new wealth. It is knowledge which fuels the new economy. And those nations that can most comprehensively commercialise knowledge will be the winners. Crossing these lines of national development is the increasing strength of global affiliation and alliance. The successful company of the future will be the one that is most virtually integrated through maximising use of new technology to generate innovative product anytime, anyhow, anywhere. On both sides of politics, there is a general agreement that Australia needs to invest strongly in emerging fields of biotechnology, information and communications technologies, and environmental research. Backing Australia's Ability and the Knowledge Nation Task Force report are in little dispute there. Our unique environment demands its tailor-made research and its specific application. Environment must be a key priority in a clever country, of course. No one else will do that research for us. Australia has also long been a leader in life sciences, where it is strongly competitive in patents and shows sustained export growth. Now, it's true that we are better users than developers of information and communications technology, but both parties agree that we must now catch up if Australia's economic growth is not to be retarded. ICT must be the driver of the new economy, the Anderson report of last December maintained. On the back of the increased investment in biotech, infotech and environmental research promised by both political parties comes a heightened thrust for commercialisation. Commercialisation takes to the private market that new knowledge which has often been generated in universities and government-funded research institutes. Here, the political platforms build directly on several other recent reports. Dr. David Kemp's Knowledge and Innovation Blueprint for Australian Research of 1999. Dr. Robin Batterham's report on Australia's science capability of last year, called The Chance to Change, and also the outcomes of last year's Innovation Summit, which was an alliance between science and business. Our particular Australian strain of commercialisation has its origins in the United States' successful attempts from the early 1990s to commercialise its public sector technology and thereby to hasten the development of new products, new processes, new business, in short, new wealth. Where then, in these national recipes announced by John Howard and Kim Beazley, do we find a vision for the reportedly other side of the intellectual equation, the humanities and social sciences? Are these just old technologies, part of the withering old economies, and as out of date as sheep and coal? Or do they have a role in the new knowledge economy? Some 40% of the Australian university sector resides in the humanities and social sciences. That means about 250,000 students and some 15 or 20,000 staff. They study everything from history to psychology and from anthropology to economics. They play the piano and they speak in many different languages. I wonder, do they do research? Can they contribute to our knowledge nation? Can they even create wealth? I argue that the humanities and social sciences are integral to Australia's capacity to innovate and to develop a vibrant new economy. They are not just a sideshow to be tolerated, and they are more than just a soft heritage or entertainment fringe, in contrast to the hard worlds of science and business. Innovation is about bringing new things into society and into business. Without a people educated and willing to embark upon the innovative new journey, science's new inventions and business's new products are meaningless. It is only when invention and innovation work hand in hand that a society and its business can prosper. Australia needs, even for these highly utilitarian reasons, strong and well-resourced humanities and social sciences. Here now are a few scenarios which show why the humanities and social sciences are vital to our new knowledge-based world. Scenario one, ethics. The natural chemical cycles, for instance, of phosphorus, carbon or nitrogen, are increasingly out of balance. The world is running out of fresh water, in some parts, of fresh air. Science, which invented the means of superphosphation, intensive irrigation and low mortality rates, through which these situations have often arisen, does not have the practical tools to solve them. Their solutions lie in a cross between the subsection of philosophy called ethics and the subsection of social sciences, politics. As science commentator Ian Lowe of Griffith University commented after last week's Global Science Conference in Holland, quote, "We need a new ethical commitment to live within the bounds of natural systems." Now, ethics and social commitment are the key tools of the solution, and they are best developed by strong educational and research programs in ethics and social sciences. In medical science, biotechnology, studies of other cultures, even commercialisation itself, important ethical questions arise. When we take that government-funded research finding and commercialise it, for instance, through involvement of private industry, what ethics are involved? Do we, for instance, as owners of the government-funded research findings, deal only with the biggest commercial players and so enhance their market position? Or do we foster start-ups and emergent players and so bring about a greater sense of competition? Ethics is a vital tool for Australian science and business. Indifferent ethics can lead to lack of business trust where Australia still scores pretty highly, but not as highly as Scandinavia, and can also lead to dangerous scientific experimentation. Like our water, ethics is hard to cost, and certainly earns very little by itself. But can we afford to let our strong Australian base in philosophy slip? Scenario two, languages. Everyone says these days that it's a global world, but that doesn't mean that it's an English language world. Actually, native English speakers are declining as a percentage of the world's population. And perhaps more surprising to you, the world's percentage of wealth is overall declining in English language countries, leaving aside the United States. So, too, with the world's new favourite means of business, the web. We once thought of the web as an English language device, as another means by which English would take over the world. Indeed, it sprang from the Pentagon's loins. Those irritating scripts and accents of those foreign languages were a bit of a problem in the early web days. But with most of those problems overcome, the web has become a way of celebrating local difference in language. Very soon, actually next year, over half the material on the web will be in a language other than English. One recent study predicts that that percentage will settle at around 35% by the end of this decade. So, as a primary tool of business, what will this mean for those in the dwindling English language countries who, through cultural arrogance or educational poverty, can only communicate in English? How will our next generation of Australians measure up in accessing that two-thirds of web knowledge which is locked up in foreign languages? And that, in an Australia which now has no professor of Russian, no professor devoted full-time to German, and that has lost more academic staff over the last 4 years in Japanese than in any other language. No. Language is a vital tool for accessing knowledge as well as developing cultural pluralism and multiple perspectives upon the world. It is vital to Australia's national security interests. And like our water, it is hard to cost. But as with water, lack of national expertise may cost us incalculably in the future. I'm afraid to say that any invaders from our north are hardly likely to provide us with subtitles, after all. Scenario three, globalisation. Think of Genoa last week. $200 million was reportedly spent on security arrangements. Police in their tens of thousands, 4,000 journalists, all hungry for copy from a couple of 100,000 demonstrators. One martyr. And all to protect a discussion between 8 world leaders. Globalisation poses many issues to which we do not have ready answers. On the counter side to enhance trade and business opportunities, there are burning social questions which science and technology mostly cannot answer. They are questions of governance, security, social stratification, and of our environment. These questions prompt answers in the broader realms of sustainability, but not just ecological sustainability, also human, socio-economic, cultural and institutional sustainabilities. They raise visceral questions about our quality of life and the meaning of life, and we're ill-prepared to answer them at the moment. If we don't answer them sufficiently well, they may lead to severe civil unrest, as the threats of globalisation override its advantages in the public mind. Our society, quite reasonably, fears globalisation because of its real potential for lower standards of living for the average worker. From where will these answers to globalisation come? from the traders, maximising their profits through the very process? From science and technology? No. I suggest that the answers to the dilemmas of globalisation and the rapidly changing references of human identity will come via the holistic, long-term, sometimes fuzzy thinking in which humanists and social scientists specialise. With globalisation and anti-globalisation, we see a slow revolution already growing out of its infancy. I think we should take a leaf out of the Canadians' book with their recent $100 million New Economy initiative run through their Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council. But rather, we in Australia need a globalisation initiative. This could be a large-scale exercise in rejuvenation of our humanities and social sciences, both its research and its teaching. As the Canadians took their initiative to ensure that Canada remained high in the knowledge stakes of the new economy, so might we better prepare our citizens for the many opportunities and challenges of the new global order. The anger and alienation felt by so many, particularly the young, at the spread of neoliberal ideologies of deregulation and privatisation will not just go away. We need to inform, guide and nurture our population to answer the real fears of job losses and lower wages while also maximising globalisation's opportunities. Here is an opportunity for the humanities and social sciences to show that as well as cherishing our past and analysing our present, they can lead our future. Scenario 4, knowledge for its own sake. In a highly utilitarian age, it is almost daring to assert the intrinsic value of knowledge. I take a brief example. If we in Australia do not well document and teach, for instance, our own distinctive histories and cultures, if we do not have a strong will to preserve and transmit the learning of our own indigenous peoples and the knowledge of our own land, then we risk becoming cloned cyber junkies for whom time and place mean little. No one else in this globalising world is going to undertake these distinctive projects for us. We need strong research and teaching programs in the culture and heritage of our nation and region, so that our national stories are not lost and our population has a sense of corporate being and meaningful citizenship. Now, these four scenarios show the need for strong ethics to make damn sure we pass on a more moral world to our children, that we need strong languages for business and security advantage as well as social diversity and intellectual pluralism, that we need strong traditions so that we preserve and cherish our cultural heritage and nurture a vibrant citizenry. And we need careful, socially relevant thought about such contemporary issues as globalisation so that we deal well with the emerging slow revolution of our age. Ethics, languages, traditions and globalisation are four of the themes to be explored in the Humanities and Social Sciences Summit to be held in Canberra on tomorrow and Friday. The summit is sponsored by the Academies of Humanities and Social Sciences, the Arts Deans of Australia, and the Business Higher Education Roundtable. It is designed to explore what 21st century Australia needs of its humanities and social sciences, and how those needs must be met. As well as those four themes, there are others too. The environment, which is not only a scientific matter of salinity, and incidentally we seem to be losing an area the size of one football pitch every day in Australia to salinity. It isn't just a matter of air pollution or global warming. The environment also raises questions about the social and human consequences of changing environmental regimes. How do humans, living along the Murray River, for instance, deal with its increasing problems? How do we best target welfare to those in need? How do we keep up morale in times of rapid change? How, perhaps, using the Murray as an example, do we transplant whole communities? Another theme is governance and policy. Australia needs specialists in the systems of governance as the borders between local, national and global become less distinct, as legal jurisdictions become more insecure, and as crime operates in the interstices of society and between nations. Another theme is cultural and heritage management. For the cultural industries in Australia are booming in this century, the celebration of the centenary of Federation. Our museums, galleries and concert halls are the most obvious window to the world for the humanities and social sciences. But how do we do better in tying together, tying more closely, the relationships between museums and, say, historians or anthropologists, between libraries and those who write the books, and between concert halls and the music practitioners? These are partnerships that are important for maintaining the vitality of both sides and for ensuring that our cultural institutions are informed by the latest research and practice of our universities. One big theme of the summit will be cultural industries. Just last week, Universities UK announced a study into British investment in the arts and humanities. The arts and humanities, they wrote, feed into the fastest growing economic sector in the United Kingdom, the creative industries. The facilities they need, computers, library access, and the opportunity to exchange knowledge and pass it on, are of vital importance to the nation's economic and cultural growth. Could we foster the creative industries also in Australia? Well, yes. And where? At Queensland University of Technology, whose arts faculty next week is transformed into a faculty of creative industries, supported by $16 million of Queensland government money and a lot of institutional goodwill. Now, I'm sure that not every arts faculty in Australia would want to undertake this transformation, and nor would many find such a level of state support. But it shows that the humanities and the social sciences can change. They are on the move. They can go out to meet and create the demand for future job markets. They can professionally train as well as liberally educate. And they can enter into the commercial arena through such windows as the visual, performing and multimedia arts. In case you're wondering exactly how these creative industries came about, I quote a couple of sentences from Stuart Cunningham of QUT. He wrote a couple of weeks ago, "We need technologically savvy and creatively sophisticated inputs into a wide range of service industries." And he gave three examples. They were performance products for the tourism industry, digital design products for the wine industry, and games-based web interfaces for organisations offering youth counselling. At a national level, then, the need for pure and applied learning and strong, diverse programs in the humanities and social sciences is gaining a bit more of a sympathetic treatment than in past years. In January, the federal government's $3 billion Innovation Action Plan, while backing mainly Australia's scientific and technological abilities, did include substantially increased funding for humanities and social science research, as part of the doubling of funding over the next few years to the Australian Research Council. The opposition's Knowledge Nation Task Force report went further, as of course oppositions can always do. It devoted one of its 20 recommendations to strengthening of the humanities, social sciences and creative industries as part of an advocacy for the broad and deep lifelong education required of citizens in a rapidly moving knowledge economy. The Knowledge Nation statement also grasped the inescapable reality that the creative industries are primary generators of content. We need this content, ranging from classical and popular music through to multimedia games. We need it so that we can satisfy the increasingly long lives that the medical sciences deliver to us, and can also exploit the new potentialities for startling content presentation provided by ever-advancing communications technologies. And Knowledge Nation considered policy processes at the current imbalances of advice which look to science and business virtually alone for the answers to questions of national innovation, knowledge uptake and research priority. The new Knowledge Nation Council and Policy Unit proposed by Barry Jones's task force will draw on all disciplines, the sciences and the non-sciences together, and so fuel the broadest possible promotion of innovation. Now, certainly, there are issues of cost and feasibility in many parts of the ALP Task Force's report, and I don't really understand the meatballs and potatoes diagrams, but as an approach, it hits the mark by being inclusive rather than exclusive, and by looking to the human and social ends capable of being realised through new technological means. In short, it is a knowledge nation for agriculture as much as astronomy and accounting along with the arts. Knowledge Nation calls for an early national summit to get this bold initiative on the road. Thanks to several recent science studies, that summit will have a good picture of Australia's scientific and technological capabilities. But we lack such a recent audit of Australia's capability in the humanities and social sciences. So we lack a detailed picture also of how the humanities and social sciences might best contribute to Australia's immediate future. This week's summit in Canberra will be a first stage in that national stocktake. So, my friends, the tide is perceptibly turning. Education and research are major election issues this year, as we've rarely seen before. The broader public is realising that research does not equal science, that education is something much more than training and skills, and that the humanities and social sciences can operate in a commercial world. A knowledge economy, Australia, needs strong humanities and social sciences, for that knowledge nation is for us. In conclusion, I'd simply suggest that if you've got just a BA, don't be apologetic. In the knowledge nation of the 21st century, when content is king, your BA might be just the thing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now questions from the media. Usual rules, please give your name and the organisation that you represent. And if the media run out of questions, the public is happy to ask questions too, but in which case, I do remind you, ask a question, don't make a speech. Thank you.
With a glass in my hand, Rex Jury from the Advertiser. I was... He'd be a friend of mine, I'll bet. I was last week in Malaysia. Perhaps the governments are different there, or the government is different. It tends to tell people what they need. We tend to have a government that listens to the people, but I looked at their new cities of education, which are quite stunning. An enormous amount of money has been invested in universities and other areas of learning, which I would suggest are far ahead of anything we're doing here. How do we change political thinking in this country to compete with that sort of investment, and where does the money come from?
Well, Rex, I was going to say, if you enjoy the wine, we've got some courses in gastronomy at Adelaide University, and that could help us with a little bit of the money issue, as they're fully commercial courses. I think there are two things I would only wish to say about that, and I'd say these very much in my capacity as president of the Academy of Humanities rather than a staff member of Adelaide University. And that is that this is an issue of national priorities and of long-term rather than short-term visions. And if we do have a nation which by and large is looking for very short-term outcomes, we can't expect that people are going to be prepared to pay a lot for something that may only come to fruition in 10 or 20 years' time. So there needs to be a sustained national debate about how much we invest. And if it is true, as Malaysia and indeed many of the tigers of Southeast Asia believe, that strong investment in education gives a highly qualified citizenry, which will be highly qualified in 40 years' time and will be the leaders of your community, well, then that argument is strong with them. Why can't it be strong with us? The other aspect is that Australian universities, which already are earning very substantial percentages of their income, need to be allowed to earn more than that. And that gets around to issues of the regulation or deregulation of the tertiary market and to the capacity to commercialise various issues, such as the invitation I've given to you to our commercialised gastronomy course.
Peter Williams from the Advertiser. One of your other many titles is Pro Vice Chancellor Commercialisation at Adelaide University. Apart from wondering how on earth you combine all these jobs, what do you bring to that role? I mean, what are some of the issues that you deal with coming from, I mean, an unconventional, obviously, area to have taken on that role?
I think I bring a healthy scepticism. If you've been brought up with degrees in classical music, and indeed classics, and my first degree was in that Latin and ancient Greek to which you referred, I naturally have some opinions about the intrinsic value of knowledge. However, I also recognise that it's absolutely essential that Australian universities have to be able to generate a larger percentage of their income. And so I guess I come in with a principle that we must make sure we commercialise where that commercialisation is healthy and we don't where it isn't. And some aspects of public good research should never be commercialised, because if there is even a taint of commercial influence, no one will believe the findings of those reports. So all of our society hangs upon the clean sources of public good research, and that needs to be funded by the public, not funded by private corporations. Other than that, I could refer you to various articles of mine, but I won't bore you with that.
Tim Lloyd from the Advertiser. I think you've made a very good case for the commercial benefits of the humanities, but I agree wholeheartedly with that, and I think the humanities probably are critical to what goes on in the next decade or two. But I still can't see how it seems to me anyway, that perhaps you're trying to sort of harness the commercial potential of that for the universities, whereas it seems to me maybe the humanities win all of their commercial sort of benefits as graduates go out into the community and practice their various skills. So how do you rationalise trying to bring that commercial potential back to university where they're being trained, rather than saying, go out there and be creative, design your web pages, make your artistic product that has copyright and all the rest of it?
Maybe the analogy of water is a useful one once again. That if our society thinks that there is a free flow of graduates who are just suddenly there with their BAs and their dip eds and other qualifications, then that's not a very good way of gaining a full appreciation of the value of the society's investment. So I think as many people realise that value in business and some technological areas, it's important to encourage a sense of that value, that why the person is employable in the job when they graduate is because of what they've learned, not just in their tertiary but also in their primary and secondary environment. Then there's an issue: how much is the public prepared to pay for that investment, and how much should or might the individual be paying for it? And I think in a fairly liberal society that has a variety of different educational products and courses available, there is a possibility for people to pitch themselves as they see fit and to take an individual responsibility for the outcomes they get from their studies.
Professor Gillis, Bruno Ventura, not from the Advertiser or any other media outlet. I'm actually from the Adelaide City Council, and I'm speaking on my own behalf, not the council. I liked your speech, in particular when it referred to the past civilizations, languages, etc. I'm always the optimist, and I hope that computers will help us to overcome this globalization minestrone that has no sense in a lot of cases. How could institutions like the Adelaide City Council or governments or government departments could help in making what you suggested a reality?
This is difficult. I suggest firstly by looking very kindly upon our tertiary institutions in every possible way so that they can get on as well as possible with their educational and research business. I think you are right that the computer was once looked upon as being the mechanism of globalisation, while now it's actually increasingly a mechanism of localisation. So there are many ways in which we can use our computing capacities to develop more that sense of local identity. And that involves everything from websites to areas which advertise jobs to areas in which people can literally involve themselves in performances across the web. This is something that's increasingly happening in music, for instance. There are web performances that tie people up in different places of the world. I think, however, that and the most important issue is pressure through political parties and through political affiliations upon those who have the largest stakes in funding. That if we don't have strong investment, strong public investment, particularly in our undergraduate education, we don't have the opportunity to go through these issues of teaching languages and traditions well. And there's a point past which it's very difficult to give a quality educational product. I mean, if you're in a lecture theatre of 600 people, it's hard to give individualised attention unless you've got good tutorial and small group seminar backup. So I would say those people in local government, those people in the city council, there's an issue here of talking about how those values are important to the citizenry of the area or the city and making sure that it's heard through all the political affiliations.
I wasn't going to say anything this time because last time was a little bit of a disturbance. But the lady next to me has reached 3 score and 10, and she certainly encouraged me to ask you this question. Concerning the ethical problem of our society, and one of them is that we are constantly being forced into a racial category. This morning I met a gentleman who has a worry. His wife lives on a reserve, and yet because he refuses to identify himself in racial terms, he's not allowed to join his wife. Now, can you respond to that or comment on that and perhaps throw it up at your conference? How ethical is it to force Australians into a racial category, in particular with reference to the Racial Hatred Act?
And you were?
Frederick Tobin.
Thank you.
I think it's certainly an interesting issue to be discussed and is the kind of issue that is discussed in so many undergraduate classes. It's one that I'd be happy to see come up at the summit tomorrow. Thanks.
Brad Crouch from the Sunday Mail. It's obviously very hard to argue against education or anything called the humanities. You'd be mad to try and do so. I'm interested in just one aspect, off on a little bit of a tangent. The tertiary sector is now seen very much as an export sector. We're getting paid students coming in from all over the world to go through our facilities, which is fantastic. It's money-making and all the rest of it. But there is some feedback coming through in anecdotal senses from people who are a bit reluctant to go on the record, suggesting that some of the fee-paying students are being given a hand to go through, that if they are failed, it's going to be a big problem for individual tertiary institutions, for our educational sector as a whole. I'm just wondering, are you getting any feedback along those lines? And if that is a case, or even if it's a possibility, will it downgrade and devalue the value of our degrees for our domestic students, for our international students, and for our educational sector as a whole?
I'd say right away that assessment is not an area that can or should ever be commercialised. Assessment has to be without fear or favour, and those people who may practice any fear or favour in assessment will find that the results are very unfortunate. I don't believe that that is a hallmark of Australian tertiary education. Obviously, we have to make sure and be vigilant that it never is.
Judith Bryan, University of Adelaide, which is not graceful of me because the Adelaide City Council has paid for my lunch.
Well done, Judith. And can the rest of you make note of that too?
Mine's an academic question. I'm curious. I thought your speech was a very graceful analysis. But I'm curious as to the dichotomy you gave of knowledge, sciences versus the humanities. And I wonder, considering our mutual interest in the faculty, how the professions got left out and the particular sort of knowledge the professions bring.
I think it's unfortunate, and I think my speech indicates this, that we tend to think of things as science and non-science. Unfortunately, the easy ability of policymakers to equate science with research has led us into that position. And it's a position of being defined as the other. I think that the professions are in an interesting position, and here I refer to law, areas of commerce, to take two examples, architecture, to take another. I think that they have perhaps suffered most of all in the current debates about research, that they have been seen to have their own rewards in terms of the perceived value of the community in their degrees and their training, and so their research has not been taken that seriously. But let me say, Australia has in many of the professions areas not been an international leader, and the indices indicate this. In the areas of, for instance, law, Australia hasn't been at the cutting edge of international development. It would be good to see that happen, but I think it will happen by the humanities and social sciences, which relate in principles very closely to the professions in many cases, by them gaining seats at, for instance, national policy tables, and thereby being able to make sure that the process is still expanded further. The creative arts have also been only a very recent entrant into Australian thinking about research, 5% of the university sector, under 1% of the research funding. That is another area that, as time goes by, must be developed if we want to have a plural educational system. And if we don't, we at least must make that decision, and those going into those areas must know that quite clearly.
Ray Lyons, I'm just an ordinary fellow.
Hi, Ray.
You mentioned about the web being more slanted towards other languages other than English. I've often puzzled about what sort of language I should learn as a second language, only learning English badly. I wondered what your view was on a second language for an Australian-speaking person.
Well, at Adelaide University, we teach French and German, and we teach Japanese and Chinese. We teach Latin and Ancient Greek. They're just six to begin with. They'd all be excellent languages to learn. Let me recommend them to you. Your question poses the deeper issue that for English speakers there isn't one natural language to learn the way for all other language speakers in the world. English is a highly prized language to learn. To look at it from their viewpoint, it gives them access to half of the capacity. Basis of Western civilization, well, Latin would be a great language to learn. Also the basis of so many European languages. Interested in trade in the Asian area, well, it could be that Japanese or Korean is the way to go. But we do have a problem. There isn't one other automatic language which we should be putting our bias towards. Hence, we have to recognise the pluralism of second languages in Australia.
Faith Trent from Flinders University. Let it be thought there were only one university in Adelaide. I'd like to follow up from Judith Bryan's question, Malcolm. When you talked about the science-non-science dichotomy and you picked the professions that you chose about, one of the professions that falls through the gap and doesn't really seem to fit anywhere and yet is touted as one of our great export earners is education. And it seems to me that unless we find some place in which that also has a voice, not only in the funding of universities but in primary and secondary schools and in terms of how you turn research into activity in what is in fact one of our greatest national treasures, there's a real problem. How do you see it sitting in terms of the meeting of the Academy tomorrow and the next day, for which I wish you good luck, and in terms of what's happening in the debate about science as well?
I think I'd recognise that in many recent debates we assume education. Again, it's like the water. We assume it's there because most of us have been going through 15 or 20 years of it. And it is interesting as being, what is it, Australia's fifth largest export industry, that we don't talk overtly about education and its developments against simple issues of how we fund a very large educational sector with a couple of million students. I think we do need to get back to the position Australia was in the 1960s and early 70s, where it really was an international leader in so much educational thought, particularly liberal educational thought. But as time's gone by, as being a teacher became downgraded as a profession, there was a corresponding downgrading, I think, in the eyes of the community and within universities of education departments. If we are going to arrest that, and there does seem to be a movement to arrest it, I noticed at Melbourne University it's harder to get into primary education than to science this year, which was a fairly unusual circumstance for Melbourne University. If we're going to see that revaluation of being a teacher, I hope it means a revaluation of educational research.
Professor, I'm Robert Mayne from the Bulletin magazine, and unlike Rex Jury, I don't have a glass of wine in my hand, but I will soon. Can you pour me one, please, sir?
Would you like to do our course too?
I'll buy you a drink after lunch. You said earlier that you didn't want to get involved in politics, and I can understand that. But it seems to me that the forthcoming federal election campaign is going to have Beazley fighting on Knowledge Nation and Howard probably fighting on tax, Howard and Costello fighting on tax cuts. Do you think people really understand what Beazley and Barry Jones are on about with this, you know, at a grassroots level?
I think they pick up a few messages, and the message of pluralism in education is one that I think the media has helped to get out about the Knowledge Nation program. I'm sure they don't understand the details, just as most people in this room probably don't even understand the details of what is and isn't regulated within the Australian university system right now. But I'll be interested in seeing, as we move towards November or December, how the debate gets sharpened up. I would question whether the coalition is able to slide away from the entirety of the education and research debate as easily as you suggest and simply play on the issue of tax cuts. I think that they will find increasingly they are put on the, on notice about a series of issues where there haven't been any policy statements yet. And despite backing Australia's ability in January and the budget in May, there are still large parts of educational and research policy which haven't been explained by the coalition. The Labor Party with Knowledge Nation has come up with an integrated plan that now needs to be fleshed out as a task force report is turned into policy.
Are we done? Are we done? It's a race.
I'll decide which one to go. Sounds from your previous answer as though if my children decide they want to do humanities at Adelaide, I'll be paying more than just the HEC scheme charges against them. Can you give me any idea of what we're facing up to in terms of those payments?
Do you mean by that possible changes in the way in which tertiary education is funded?
Yes, yeah, for education and humanities at Adelaide University. What sort of charges would you... What would you envisage beyond just the current HEX?
Yes. Well, the current HEX, which comes out at about $3,300 per year, is something which is under increasing debate. I noticed in The Australian last Wednesday there was a debate about whether there should be a super HEX that some universities may charge for the same degree, a BA for example, at a higher rate than the current $3,300, which is uniform across all of Australia, regardless of university type. In the graduate area, of course, students pay fees, and those fees vary enormously, from maybe $5,000 full time for a year up to $30,000 or $40,000. How things may change, who is to know? But I observe that we did have a report 3 or 4 years ago that talked about a voucher system that would deregulate undergraduate fee levels, but each citizen be given a voucher towards their education. We have had announced in January a postgraduate loan scheme where the government has put an extra $1 billion into loans, interest-free loans for postgraduate study. Who knows? But one thing I think we could feel certain that the current scheme won't be the same in 2 years' time.
Robert Mainzer. Squib at the best. I've got a new glass of wine. Two questions. One, they're quite different. One, why doesn't academia, if I can put it in that broad term, participate more upfront in the political debate? I've found as a journalist that academics are terrified of entering political debate, yet they surely must have the knowledge and have the arguments. Secondly, in a competitive world, and I actually support this, but in a competitive world, should Australian universities be in part financing themselves by bringing students in from overseas at high fees to help finance them, or should we be saying, no thank you, we will do it ourselves?
It's interesting why academics don't take more of a role in public debate. The death of the public intellectual is something that's much discussed. I notice you have Geoffrey Blainey coming to the next press club luncheon, and he is a public intellectual, very prominent when he was a Dean of Arts at the University of Melbourne, left that university around 1985 in the middle of the Vietnamese debate, which it in fact initiated, and yes, pursues the public intellectual role now, I think, very comfortably outside. I'd suggest to you that most academics are working damn hard at the moment, but also that the way in which we have valued comment in universities has changed. As we in universities have become very keen to enhance our research profiles, we accordingly have not been giving the same emphasis we once did to community leadership in disciplinary areas and providing comment. To give an example, the staff member who does give a lot of that comment and doesn't write so many journal articles or books is costing their department a considerable sum of money every year. Their colleagues are actually carrying them. So in moving into these highly parametricised ways of funding universities, I think we've sent a lot of disincentives to academics who privately have great comment and does sometimes spill over into the press. But we don't have the public intellectuals that we had 20 years ago. The Barry Joneses and the Geoffrey Blaineys aren't there in the 30s and 40s generation, at least within the university sector at the moment. Your second question, I think we'd have to call an ethicist in here, so I'd want to give a bit of business to our philosophers over whether we really should be playing more Australian students exclusively or entering into the global market of international education. I'd suggest to you there's nothing wrong with being in that market, that in fact the international students who come to our universities are a huge boon to us in breaking down what could otherwise be an excessive provincialism and parochialism of our own students. And I think we all appreciate hugely what they bring in. The fact that they bring in money as well, I don't think is something which should void the process, because they're seeing it as being something that's competitive. They've shopped around and they believe Australia's giving them a better bang for their buck than maybe Britain, the United States or Canada. So I don't think there's anything inherently unethical about it. But it would be good to have the debate that we never had about this. It all gradually grew as universities had a greater and greater financial pressure.
I wonder if I might ask a question. Is there anything in the structure of universities which inhibits this, what you call the emerging slow revolution of our age? Is there anything in the structures of universities themselves that are holding you back?
Yes, I think there is. To address that globalisation issue requires us to have staff who are definitely in touch with all the various issues, the social and the political and the industrial and the trading issues, but also very much in touch with that age group which is rebelling most against globalisation. We suffer in universities because of the contraction in funding over now 15 years. We suffer from a dearth of younger staff. We need to have the whole of a community represented in universities, and in some of our departments we don't. It's no one's fault, but they tend to be populated by scholars who are a little older. That, I don't think, gives us the maximal capability to respond to the globalisation issue right now. Hence, in explaining that initiative, I was seeing it as being a mechanism for rejuvenating the humanities and social sciences themselves, through the ability to bring on more younger scholars who may have the more up-to-date skills, may also have some of the greater sense of passion and connection with the people who are involved in the anti-globalisation and anti-capitalistic debate.
Thank you. Thank you for talking about ethics, language, globalisation and knowledge. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Malcolm Gillies. I was going to say I have a gift for him, but I can't find it. Behind the chair. I'll take it down to you. It's a wonderful Orlando product. You'll love it.